Hey, everybody, welcome to the Snapcast. I'm Alex.
I'm Jerry.
And I'm Rob.
All right, so for this one today, we're going to be talking about news and stuff like we always do, and then we're going to come back and talk about whatever we feel like. We're just going to play it loose for the second part this week. So, guys, what have you been up to?
All right, so I played a GPT this past weekend. It was a modern format, and I won it. Yay!
Nice, congrats.
So it's two buys for me. One curious thing I'm curious about, because I'm not 100% sure, and some of our viewers might not know about it. If you already had a buy, does it stack with the two buys you win with the GPT?
No.
All right.
No.
Good to know. But, yep.
Unless you're a Platinum Pro, the most you can have is two.
Got it.
Yep.
Good to know. All right. Well, to nobody's surprise, in Modern, I've been playing Ad Nauseam. And because of the format shaking up to be the Collected Company deck being the best deck, the Collected Company combo, that is, that deck's an auto win for me. I don't lose to that. And four people out of 15 were playing it. Guess how many of them I ran into? Three of them. So it was three free wins, and one of them was in our cut the top four.
Nice.
I didn't realize that matchup was so good for you. I figured Infinite Life is real bad.
When you mainboard Laboratory Maniac, you really don't care.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah,
they don't mainboard interaction. Yep, all right.
What other decks did you see there, Jerry?
Oh, let's see. We had our one given Tron player who was on the mono blue version. That matchup's always been kind of 50-50. It also helped that he had never played against Ad Nauseam before. He was aware of it but didn't know the matchup. And when we finished, I had won the match in two, and he pulled out his Platinum Angel, and I'm like, "You're not supposed to pull that out." You know, I told him, like, here's the ins and outs, what you're supposed to do against me. You know, keep your Platinum Angel in with your Spell Skites. Try to overload the board on threats, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but he didn't know what he was doing, so I ended up getting him there. Nobody was on burn. Too many people are afraid of Collected Company's Infinite Life, so there were no burn players. Go figure. So that was always, you know, it's always nice to see that, you know, when the linear decks are down, sometimes interaction or neat little things come out of it. We had a Jeskai control player who was very high on both Thopter Sword and Ancestral Visions. He was not doing the new Nahiri thing, which is, I think, you should be doing.
That's the hotness.
Yeah, you should be doing
that's
this.
That's the hotness. For those of you that may not have seen this yet in Modern, so Jeskai control is shifted to people who have been playing around in Mardu. Jeff Logan was playing around in Kiki Cord and stuff. You run a Nahiri and one, you know, multiple copies of Nahiri because it's real good. And then one Emrakul because you don't mind drawing the Emrakul because you just pitch it to Nahiri, shuffle in, and draw a card. And then you minus 8 Nahiri, put an Emrakul and play attacking, get your Annihilator, beat some face. It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I was always about, you know, why would you play Mardu when you're not playing either Tarmogoyf and Snapcaster? We have Nahiri now. Now we have a reason to be doing this. Besides that,
nice.
Just a couple of Jund players that were around. It's not a good matchup for me, but I do know how to play against it. One of them had never played against Ad Nauseam before. You know, won that match. Because, you know, people don't know, so you're going to get them.
Modern is such a diverse format that it's hard to know everything, but it really rewards you when you do.
Hey, what are you talking about? I know everything.
Yeah, all right, Jerry. Keep telling yourself that, mate.
Yeah, we'll talk later about Dragonstorm.
And about how you think it's a good deck.
Oh my god. Worst thing I bought.
Alright, Rob, what'd you do this weekend, man?
I too ran in a GPT down here in the Jacksonville area, and just like Jerry, I won. Mine was a day after Jerry's, so Jerry kind of put the pressure on me. I can't have Jerry be the only one with two buys. I definitely need to do something with it. So
I have two buys too, but I earned them.
Right. Oh hey, we earned ours just in a shorter fashion.
Yeah, and one tournament and it's only four win tournament. I earned my two buys right for the whole GP year.
Nice. But it was what's odd hearing the matches that Jerry played against, it's very similar to what I went against. My first match was the mirror match against a guy brand new to Magic, and he was playing Scapeshift.
What were you playing? You never said what were you playing, Rob?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was playing Titan Shift, the red green Scapeshift list.
You can't open with playing the mirror and nobody knows what the mirror is.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But no, it's the all-in version of Scapeshift. It's just red and green. There's no counter spells, and your interaction is either bolting with Valakut or bolting with Lightning Bolt. And you have Primeval Titan, which I like. I like big stompy creatures. But yeah, no, my first match was the mirror. Then I ran into Jund, and I really wasn't sure how it was going to go because of the hand destruction, but I was able to get that one. American Control as well. He was on the Nahiri plan, but he had not played Titan Shift before or Scape Shift, so he really didn't know what to do against it. There was one Coco player there. I ran into him and crushed him. And then my only loss came from Ad Nauseam. Jerry.
Oops, I mean, can't help it, man. If I run into a Titan Shift, man, that's almost an auto win.
Yeah, no, it is. There's not much of anything I can do with, since I don't have counter spells or anything like that. I don't run the Bring to Light version, so I could board in Slaughter Games and just call out your cards. So it's one of those I'm just going to take as a bad matchup, and hopefully it goes through.
I mean, I've said it before, but that's Modern. Like, no deck in Modern doesn't have a bad matchup. Otherwise, everyone would play it. Like, every deck has a bad matchup or match that is really tough to win, and you just have to try to dodge those matchups.
Right, and that's pretty much what I'm doing is I'm set on my sideboard. I think it's great against the majority of the top decks that you expect to see, and the occasional random decks that you'll run into, like I've done on Moto and running into Ad Nauseam, just going to have to do my best.
Yep, no, I understand.
Hey, sometimes they never hit the combo, so go for it.
Exactly. Yep.
It's true.
What about you, Alex?
I had a little less stellar weekend than you guys. I decided to play Moto PPTQ. It was sealed. My suit pool was all right. It was nothing insane. What I had going for me was I had Mind Rack Demon and Gold Knight Castigator. So I just had like the biggest, fattest flyers in the format. Right. I did all right. It's five rounds. You have to go 4-1 or 5-0 to make the finals, earn the token to play in a finals, which could be the next day or whenever you have time to play it. I went 3-2. I lost one to an opponent that just had the green white nuts. He had Sigarda, Westphal Abbey, Hanawar Captain, and Avacyn.
Sure.
Oh, wow.
So, like, perfect.
Yeah. I can't beat that. Like, you got me. And then I lost the last round that was a potential, win and play the finals on a punt. And then I opened 3-1 landers. And I kept the third one on 5 anyway, and the game was over.
Yeah. For those of you who aren't aware, Hanawar Captain is basically a not quite so overpowered version, but a very similar card to Pack Rat, to where it just adds to the board every turn. Gets out of control too quickly on its own.
Yep. And then combine that with Westphal Abbey, and it was just a pain.
Yeah. Hanawar Captain, you might not even be in white, but you need to force yourself into white to play the card. That's how I feel about it.
No, that card is real good. Yep. So, I mean, it is what it is. It's sealed. That's going to happen. Like, you're just going to find somebody with a better pool than you. And a lot of it will come down to interaction at that point. And I had a lot of interaction. I had a bunch of, I had Lightning Axe and Fiery Temper and a couple Throttles. Like, and a Sinister Concoction. Like, I had good removal. I just didn't find any at the times I needed it. But like I said, it's sealed. It happens. So let's get into some news.
Ooh, yes.
First up, we got an article from the mothership, or whatever you want to call it, magic.wizards.com, written by Mark Rosewater, called "Because Salt Makes Mistakes Taste Great." And the reason I want to talk about this one is because in there, he mentions that Battle for Zendikar and Oath of the Gatewatch was a mistake. And the reason he says it was a mistake is people loved Zendikar because it was a land-based set. It was, land mechanics. It was there's adventures going on. It was flavorful. Like, all the art was just great out of it. It had its own, art style. It was very wild, like jungles and stuff. And he wanted to return to that. But they made the mistake in design. They didn't return to Zendikar, they returned to Rise of Eldrazi. And I agree with that 100%, that's what those two sets felt like. And that's why I didn't like it, because people didn't like Rise of Eldrazi.
Yeah.
How do you guys feel about it?
He made some good points in reference to, battle being more like Rise of the Eldrazi. For those who ever played the limited format, it was a different type of limited world where it was based on Battlecruiser Magic, to where the tried and true traditional archetypes were not good. They were the traps, pun intended, because the trap mechanic was a thing in the previous two sets. But, it was a trap to play those. You needed to be playing big, monstrous Eldrazi and getting through with them. A lot of people weren't doing that. So what ends up happening is, you know, the people that hail it as the greatest limited environment that they've ever played are the pros, you know, the 1% of Magic players. The other 99% don't get it, why people say it is. It was a pretty bad set for most people. They also missed on with the design of Battle for Zendikar and Oath of the Gatewatch is they didn't actually go back to Zendikar, you know? We didn't have our adventure tropes that we love so much, the different equipment theme, the different trap themes. You know, there weren't as many land-based effects that we liked seeing, you know? The ones back in original Zendikar were more powerful. The ones that we have now are not quite on that level, if you see what I'm getting at with this. They just...
Oh, no, I agree.
It's basically we just went back to Rise of the Eldrazi, which was a mediocre set at best, and just labeled it Zendikar, and people would buy packs.
What do you got, Rob?
No, I have to completely agree with it. The Battle for Zendikar, there was all of the hype. Yes, we're going to Zendikar, and I think the equipment feel of it, and pretty much not to reiterate what you guys are saying, but that is exactly what was missing from it. And it seems that we focused on the last part, which was the Eldrazi, because the Eldrazi presence was huge. And then we saw it take over all three formats, essentially. It's still kind of working in Legacy some, but I mean, we saw it with the Eldrazi Winter in Modern and the Rise of Eldrazi decks that we had in Standard. So yeah, it was awkward because it's like, yes, Zendikar. No, it's more like Rise of Eldrazi. And the analogy that he used was great. He said that it's like taking his family to Disney World or Disneyland, and then on the last day, they go to the Hall of Presidents. And then they're like, hey, guys, we're going to go back to Disneyland. And where does he take them? The Hall of Presidents. And that's it.
Fair enough. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I get where that's coming from. But what he fails to mention in the article is what was wrong with the set was he didn't look back in the past and just make sure, like, hey, are these cards able to be played fairly with, you know, whatever we had already made for Eldrazi? He fails to mention that at all. And I feel like that's, you know, a big omission on Mero's part that should have happened.
Yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from, Jay, but they've had enough, you know, Eldrazi winter happened. They've had enough. Where they're trying to move past it. They don't want to address it anymore. Like they've made their apology somewhat in the unbans that we got and saying that Modern is no longer a Pro Tour format, so that there's not going to be more shakeup bans and things like that. They've apologized in that way, in my opinion. But moving on here, GP New York was this weekend. So it was won by Black White Control by Seth Manfield, number one ranked player in the world right now. Also notable, Mike Zegras went 15-1, his only loss coming in the top eight. He did the 15-0 run through the normal rounds as well, because nobody's done that, the, you know, 18-0. That's what people are shooting for right now, it feels like.
Yeah.
And then, go ahead, Rob.
This was the second week in a row that we had someone go 15-0 in rounds. And then, yeah, as soon as they entered the top eight, you know, it's a shame to see him lose, but yeah, just out.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it a little bit when we were talking about last week where we said, man, I would take these last two buys and, you know, refresh yourself because, like, you'd much rather be, you know, have a record of 15-1 and be in the top four because that one loss came somewhere in rounds and then, you know, your extra wins got you into the top four than losing the first round of top eight.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I would rather just have my buys and just continue from the, you know, my two buys from the beginning, play it out. Oh, look, I'm perfect. Got two rounds left. Bye-bye. Or not bye-bye, but draw, I'm in.
Right. Nope. So going into the top eight, we had three green-white tokens, still the deck to beat in Standard, two of the four-color Cryptolith Rites, and the other three were Control. Two of them were black-white, and one was Grixis. So just kind of looking at this, but what's at the top, it's kind of looking like the format started to stabilize a little bit in this kind of mid-range wide strategies in tokens and Cryptolith Rites versus Control. There was a lot more Control with this one. There's Black White, there's Grixis running around. What do you guys think?
It's really just a game of languishes versus your token producers and your always watchings. The green-white tokens deck, though, has a lot of upside in that you have access to some of the best removal white has ever had. In a standard format. Like, you know, usually you'll get one very powerful white spell and a bunch of mediocre ones. And now we have two in Declaration in Stone and Stasis Snare.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. White hasn't, like, other than just a straight sweeper, white has never really had a good way to get rid of tokens. They're usually the one making tokens, so Declaration in Stone does something that white has never had before. What do you think about these Cryptolith Rites decks?
So, these Cryptolith Rites decks are coming across as basic versions of the original Rally decks that we are kind of into now. And, man, these decks are just, like, they're playing some of the just bad cards, but when they come together, they create, you know, obviously we have the infinite combo with the Eldrazi, Zulaport Cutthroat, and Brood Monitor. You know, that whole combo right there is just, it's unbelievable that that's even a thing right now in Standard because of that. But with the power of Collected Company, it can be just as easy as end of turn Collected Company. Oh, look, I had a Cryptolith right. I'm going to tap my dudes, play Brood Monitor, and game's over. So it's almost like its own Standard version of a twin, you know, your twin, you win type thing.
I mean, it's just nice to close out a game like that. Like, Green-White Tokens is kind of playing combo. It wants to, you know, end of turn secure. It has the Secure the Waste, Westfield Abbey combo, if you will, where I just end of turn Secure the Waste, activate Westfield Abbey, I have an Ormondal attacking. And that should be good enough to close out a game because it's very hard to deal with.
Yep.
This just takes that a step further to where the game is over. Like, I win.
Absolutely. It goes even further, goes even harder. And some versions of the deck, you know, sometimes you do go back on the old school Husk plan. Like, you just have too many dudes on the battlefield, two Zulaport Cutthroats. Well, I'm going to sack five dudes, you lose 10, I gain 10, and I'm going to hit you with this Husk. And, you know, that's a tried and true plan. It always comes back, always has been around in, you know, Standard whenever Husk is around. So why not keep it around?
Yep. I mean, and this is funny because this is one of those combos that, like, when the set was first spoiled, when Eldrazi Displacer came out, people were like, hey, this combo's with Brood Monitor and Zulaport Cutthroat. And everybody's like, haha, that's cute. Nobody's going to run that. Well, turns out with like Cryptolith Rites, and you can just make a bunch of mana, it's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like you said, TPs are you know, collected combo, a bowl. Like, you just end a turn and hit the two you need. Or even just having one, you know, collected company looking for 3-6 cards to find another piece, and then having like the Brood Monitor in hand is great. But also with Grand Prix New York here, there was a lack of coverage. Day one was not streamed on Twitch. There's no coverage of it. They started in day two. They started early. Originally, the plan was just going to be they were going to stream top eight. They started a little bit early because LSV didn't do so good, so he went into the booth to do coverage. Or maybe it was Redo. I can't remember. One of them. What do you guys think about their cutting down on coverage?
All right, so here's how coverage for Magic has always been. It sucks. It's been terrible. No one has ever been able to make it to where it was more viewer-friendly. Magic already, as it is, isn't really a spectator sport. It's kind of hard to watch games because of the way that, you know, just putting a camera over a table and you expect people to know what the cards are. If you want, you know, fans and spectators to watch that don't know the game, we need to be able to see what is going on. We need commentators that actually know what they're talking about. We've had a history of guys speaking in the booth that really don't know a thing about what's going on. And that's always been a big downplay. The quality could be better. Instead of just a camera hanging over, you know, we could almost set it up to where, like, you have a picture of these two guys thinking, looking at their cards and such, and, like, a digitized board in between the middle of them that's being recorded from a computer where you can actually physically see the cards, you know? You see what is going on. They're clear. You know, we can read them. You know, actually having commentators that know what they're talking about. It might sound silly, but, you know, that comes up quite a bit.
I mean, that's to a certain extent. I think Wizards of the Coast and Channel Fireball are much better in their coverage, in my opinion, because usually, like, Wizards of the Coast has people like Randy Buehler in the booth, who's a Hall of Famer. He knows Magic in and out and things like that. Like, and then Channel Fireball usually has some of their sponsored players who aren't playing in the booth, like, you know, LSV or Reed Duke or these guys that know the game also very well in and out. So I think they do an all right job.
I like the video quality that is given to us by Star City, because they do just like what you said, Jerry. They have the multiple camera angles so that you can kind of see what's in the hand. You know, you got camera on player faces and things like that. It's a little bit crisper. But the commentary, though, that we do get from Channel Fireball and Wizards of the Coast is just bounds and leaps better. Star City, it seems like, you know, they just cut a couple of their main guys, and now they're just bringing in, hey, this guy did decent for us for a while. Let's have him commentate. Cough, cough, Chris Van Meter, cough. But, I mean, it's if we could see a good melding of both of that, I think it would be great. And I really enjoy watching it. I know other people like watching the Magic coverage just because it's another way to study a deck and to see how people would play it against other decks rather than trying to find videos on YouTube or trying to get someone to play test with you that may not be as experienced.
Like something as simple
I think a lot of it is. No, go ahead, Jay.
All right, something as simple as like, you know, how they do in the poker games on ESPN, where they show like on the sides where each player's hand is, something like that. Can we like something as simple as that would just improve quality that much?
I can kind of see that, but then you get like, I don't know. There's risks of broadcasting what's in people's hands. I mean, obviously, like, you can't have your phone sitting there. Like, they don't allow you to have electronics, you know, at the game and stuff. But, like, that's just asking for somebody to break that system.
Sure. I mean, but they do it in poker where millions of dollars are on the line versus Magic where we're only at a couple thousands of dollars. I don't see why, you know, you couldn't do something like that.
I think that the issue with that is the poker tournaments, they're not live. It's a post-production of is what you're seeing. You're not seeing it as it's happening, like what we have with the Magic tournaments.
Exactly. And
in a way, they can. Wizards does every once in a while. They'll pop up, you know, the list of cards that they have in their hand. They give you a reminder. But also, too, sometimes they shuffle too quick, and you don't know what they have in their hand. And rather than, I would say, putting up wrong information, they elect not to put up any.
Okay.
Yeah, right. They have it, like, at the Pro Tours and stuff, they have a guy sitting there with an iPad, you know, one on each side of the person in the feature match that looks at their hands, you know, types it into the iPad to send it up to the booth so the booth knows, and that's when they put up that little, their little thing where it shows what's in their hand and stuff, their little, you know, graphic for it or whatever. But yeah, I agree with Rob there, that they just, they err on the side of caution where they say, oh, we are not 100%. We don't want to say the wrong things. We just won't put it up unless we're 100% sure what the hand is.
Okay, that's reasonable. I'm just saying, you know, anything to improve the quality of the coverage, I'm all about. Obviously, the logistics behind that are much more difficult because, you know, like you said, person A's got to be looking at hand, goes to person B goes to person C plugs it into the computer. You know, it's a game of telephone. The message goes around and it gets mixed up. So the logistics behind that don't make too much sense, but it's not impossible, and it's something different, and we need ways to get viewers. I mean, we had an issue where the most recent Pro Tour only had 27,000 views versus Hearthstone, which would always has about like almost like 500,000 views. League of Legends has millions upon millions of viewers for their different series. You know, Magic wants to get up on that level. And the only people that are really watching these events are the diehard fans, such as myself and you guys.
Well, a lot of people watch, like kind of Rob mentioned it there, where they want to see matchups. They want to see, you know, how does this pro player sideboard? Like, what is he, you know, what lines of play does he take and stuff? So I think Magic is a great game to watch on like YouTube, to go back to the archive matches, to do research, you know, to really look at these lines of play. Just kind of get into the head of a pro. What was he thinking here? You know, what was his sideboard plan and stuff? But yeah, live, there's a lot of logistical problems.
It would be nice to see just an increase in it. Because I did a look. I've been definitely focused more on GPs. I don't know if it's because of the upcoming GP or I've noticed the reduction in Star City Games Opens since they've moved all to East Coast. They've also cut down on how many weeks they're doing it each season. But there's only two that Wizards is going to be covering between now and the next Pro Tour. And there's a total of 13 of them being played across the world. So yeah, sure, whenever it's in Australia, the time is completely different. But it's something that can be archived. So I don't know. I'm not a fan of the lack of coverage. I would like to see something come up. Maybe Wizards is busy with something else, trying to regain the trust of pros. Who knows?
I mean, a lot of it comes down to the logistics of just moving all this equipment.
Yeah.
Like, there's 13 Grand Prix, but, you know, if four of them are in Europe where they're out of the way, or like in Australia, like you said, or like, you know, a Hawaii or something, like, just flying this equipment around the whole time is just it's a pain. So I appreciate what they give us just for that reason alone.
Oh yeah, no, this is definitely not a I hate Wizards kind of thing. We love what they provide. It's just we're greedy. We want more.
Right. We want better quality.
Right.
Because another, like, something we haven't even mentioned yet that has always bothered me about coverage is the glare. Like, I understand it needs to be lit, and I understand top-down is the best view, but sometimes I just can't even read a card on the field because there's just a glare on the sleeve.
Yep. That's always annoying. You're trying to squint at it. What is that card? If I tilt my head, can I read it?
Yeah. I think it's this, but coverage said it was that, so I don't know what it is.
I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah. All right, you guys got any closing thoughts for this one?
No, not really. That about covers it for news. This is a slow week.
It was a little slow.
No, I'm just excited about our segment two.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
It's going to be awesome.
All right, guys, that'll do it for us for the news here. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about something. Hey everybody, welcome back. During the break, we decided we're going to talk about some stuff about playgroups and playtesting and stuff like that, and we'll talk about some other stuff. Let's figure it out. We're going to freeform it, figure it out as we go. So let's talk about some dynamics of, you know, a playtesting group, because we used to playtest as a group when we were all on the East Coast. We've since scattered to the winds a little bit, and we've had to establish new playtesting groups and things like that. So why do you guys like having a playtest group?
I like having diversity in my playtest group. I want to play against someone that knows what they're doing, you know, knows their craft, and then there'd be some other guy who knows their other part of their craft. Like, Alex, I know you are my go-to twin player. If I needed to learn a matchup against twin, I could go to you. I loved having that in our group.
Thanks for rubbing that one in. Just saw the wounds. I thought I was healed.
Sorry, bro.
Just rip them open.
Rip the stitches out. Skip it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you all know that I'm the combo player. If y'all want to learn a combo or learn a matchup against any given combo.
I love how you go from Alex, you know, twin to I'm the combo player.
All right, twin wasn't a combo. Completely different argument. Twin is a combo inside of an awesome control deck that we all love. But you know what I'm talking about when I say combo. I'm talking dedicated.
Yeah, I'm just giving crap.
Dedication station population ad nauseum. You know, best card ever.
And Dragonstorm garbage.
Hey! All right, let's leave Dragonstorm out of this. But you know, we get the idea. You know, I always like having anyone that I can have that's specialized in something. You know, Chris plays Legacy Elves. I don't know anybody else who could play it any better than him. You know, I've tried playing the deck, and sometimes I get it right away. Other times, I just look at it, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, Creature Storm, what am I supposed to do here? But Chris always knows. So if I need to test against some type of aggressive strategy, I'll go to Chris. If I need to test against control, I'll jam against Bobby. You know, he loves doing all the do-nothing control decks between Urza-Tron or Jeskai control, you know? So, again, I'll say it. I like having a good, diverse group of people that know their craft.
What are your opinions, Rob?
No, I agree with that. In your play group, you are going to want, like, it's good, I guess, to have like-minded people, but you want those who also play different archetypes. Because if you just have the same group of people, say, like, we ran into this up at the game store in Northern Virginia. With Legacy, we had a whole bunch of Miracles players, and that's all they really knew was Miracles. And, I mean, their matchups against other decks were all right, but I like being able to have that dedicated tempo mid-range person, Alex. I like having the combo player. Yep, you, Jerry. Control, Bobby, Chris, again, low to the ground, aggro and that. And getting the advice then from each player of, this is what I would have done with your deck against me. This is what I'm weak against. This is what, you know, this is a waste of time for you to board in against me. And being able to find that is going to help you grow as a player. And I thankfully last weekend I was able to find that. And me and one of the guys were actually going to Tampa this weekend. So hopefully then, you know, this will help build that bond even more. I'll see him in Charlotte along with Jerry. And no, it's good having the multiple groups or the multiple archetypes within it, because it helps you out.
I mean, there is an argument. I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here and say, yes, I wouldn't mind having, you know, a playtest group that is just for one deck. Like, I know at the last, the Modern Pro Tour that everyone was upset about or whatever, they had an affinity group, the affinity aficionados or whatever, like Patrick Dickman, Frank Carson, and all them got together to just hammer out the best affinity list and like the best sideboard and what to expect and things like that. And I like that because I've done a lot of testing myself with just like brews and you know, other decks that are running stuff. I can't play every matchup. I can't play, you know, right now I'm playing Blue Moon and Modern. I can't play, you know, Blue Moon against every Modern deck. Like, I just don't have the hours in the day. I don't have the time. Like, and even then, if I play it, the matchup once and my opponent, you know, struggles or has to mulligan or their deck doesn't perform the way it usually does, that testing doesn't do me anything. So I like the idea of having, you know, a bunch of other people that play the same deck. Like, I've connected with a couple guys here that play Blue Moon as well, that we get together and we say, what do we think we need in the sideboard for like these matchups? Because they might have more experience playing that matchup and say, oh, I had this card and it was really good in this particular matchup. I think you should give it a try. So I really like that dynamic as well.
I think go ahead, Rob.
I definitely agree with you on that, having that team deck so you can get as many reps with the deck as possible. And that's what we see a lot at the Pro Tours. That's where you really see your team deck strive. You kind of see it at the Opens. It's also more visible at your GPs and that. But yeah, the wealth of information you get and being able to perfect your 75 is, there's not enough time for you to do it while you're trying to balance your personal life, while you're trying to balance a job, going to school, whatever it is that you do. And having that play group, those are the benefits to it. And hopefully, you know, you will be able to help each other out in the areas where, you know, something might be lacking. You might not have that one person who's incredibly smart and overly well-rounded. And, you know, you could miss something. That's the only downside I see to that.
I mean, I see what you're saying there, but like also with having a play group where everybody has their own deck. Like, and once again, I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I'm just playing a little bit of devil's advocate here. Where like, Rob, what in Modern you're playing Titan Shift right now, and I'm playing Blue Moon. Well, if we're in a play test together, yeah, we can play test the Titan Shift Blue Moon matchup, you know, till the sun goes down. But we may not gain anything from that. Like, right, having the same group playing against the same decks the whole time doesn't help you improve other matchups.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I agree with that, which is where I think proxy decks come in. But we can get to that in a little bit. Jerry, what were you going to say?
That's actually where I was going to head on to, was hitting up on the proxy decks.
All right, well, start us off.
All right, sure. So with proxy decks, it's always good, you know, to have them. First off, rules with proxies, like print them out. Don't write on the back of a card. Have it printed out. Be able to read everything that is typed out, printed, whatever have you, however you want to do it. Just make sure it's legible and not just all scribbles on the back of a Magic card. Great way to help out. Great way to start. Proxy decks are really good to practice with as well. Learning, hey, maybe you do like this strategy better than the one you currently run. But beyond that, with proxy decks, it's kind of on the team's responsibility that everyone at least is aware of how to play this deck at a given time, because, you know, you need to be able to test your deck as much as you can against this given archetype. You know, we have a proxy affinity deck. We need that around. It's too common of a deck in the Modern format. So all of us at least needs to be familiar with how to play affinity.
No, I agree with that. And then also, like, it gives your, for the more specialized groups, when you have like an aggro guy, well, if he has like, you know, maybe he runs affinity, but if he has access to, you know, a proxy burn, a proxy infect, his aggro ability will help him carry in those, and he'll be a better pilot of those decks as well to help you guys play test against, if that makes sense. Well, I was trying to say that.
Yeah, no, it's using their already known skill with a like deck to hopefully allow them to pilot it better than, say, someone who's mainly control player. Control player isn't going to be that great at piloting an infect deck as someone who's been running like Zoo or tokens.
Right.
So you definitely need, you know, need to take that into account whenever you do deal out your proxy decks. And that's like, okay, I want you to play this while I run this to see how the matchup is. Same way, vice versa. You don't want your aggro player to try to go on like Gifts Control. He's not going to be able to pilot that too well. He's like, there's no creatures on the board. What do I do?
All right. So we've kind of brushed on a little bit here, but I think I want to focus in a little bit more. We'll start with Jerry. Like, why do you want a playtest group? What benefits do you think you get out of it?
Multiple eyes on a single game of Magic. You know, I like the idea of having four or five people, you know, three people watching, two people playing. This way, you all can eyeball what I'm doing wrong, or on the other side of the table, like if I'm playing a deck I'm super familiar with and he's learning something new and he's trying to beat this certain matchup, you know, I can eyeball, like we mentioned it earlier, to where I can point out something he should be doing against me if he's not doing it. You know, things like that are always really good. Another reason to have a playtest group is to be able to hash out multiple matchups at a given time. You know, if there's six of us here and three of us are getting into playtest against different gauntlets, you know, hey, you know, we can keep rotating a group of players around with a given proxy deck and get in good matchups with these three decks that are being moved around.
All right, what do you think, Grub?
No, I feel like I'm a broken record here. It's just having that play group, have one match go on at a time. Say there's like four people, and then have the other two guys analyze that match. You know, looking at your hand, not really get you to vocalize what your lines of play are. Try to take your matches seriously, like it's like you're at an open, like you're at a GP. And then at the end of it, they can tell you, hey, at this point, you had this line of play. Did you not see it, or why did you not take it? And then you can hash out, oh, well, I thought, you know, I was trying to be safer by playing around this. I don't want to force him into a counter at this point, or I do, so that's why I did this instead. And they will be able to get you to work through things better, especially sequencing. Right now, I am in probably the highest learning curve for sequencing that I've been in with any deck in Scapeshift, since I'm trying to make every mountain play count with Valakut on board. And every game I'm noticing small areas where I could have sequenced things better. And I know if I had other people watching me who knew the deck, they would be able to point those out as well, and probably in a lot more areas than what I'm missing.
So based on what you said there, Rob, I think we should try this. Not now, obviously, not with the upcoming Grand Prix, but after this Grand Prix, whatever event we go to next, whatever format it is, I say we all jump on this one deck. We should try that. Pick a deck that we all really like and learn it all together and see if we get up different results. You know, maybe we all day two or something like that. I would like to try that out.
Yeah, I'm all for
it. I mean, I'd be done. Yeah.
All right. Just getting back on track here a little bit. Thanks, Jerry. for me personally, I touched on it earlier. You can't play test enough. There's not enough, you know, hours and stuff. But in older formats, you know, Modern and Legacy, it's very rewarding to know your decks and to know your matchup. Like, tournaments are so diverse. There's so many decks in the formats that any given round you can play anything. So just having an advantage of, oh, I've played this matchup before and my opponent hasn't. No, so I have an advantage of what I need to do and what I have a game plan going into it that maybe my opponent has to figure out on the fly. So he'll miss something or make a small mistake, and you kind of leverage these advantages. So playing your deck is good. But if at any given time you need to switch, like, you know, the meta, you're like, oh, I need to switch to this Modern deck, or, you know, the Modern deck I was playing is just not good right now, or same in Legacy and stuff like that. Having a playtest group of this other guy has been running this deck the whole time. Like, you don't necessarily have the knowledge immediately of how this deck works, or, you know, the hours logged on it and know these matchups, but you can go to this guy and say, hey man, write me a guide, you know, write me out, how do I sideboard in this matchup, like what cards are problematic, what do I need to worry about, what do I need answers for immediately, what can I let slide. And it just catches you up so much to switch decks within a playtest group with somebody that can help you.
I completely agree with that. That's what I ended up doing. when I got back, I saw that Infect was doing very well. but I also saw all of the Coco decks that were out there running Malira and things like that, and I was keeping a keen eye on that because Malira shuts me down completely. I found a deck I liked in Scapeshift, and then I started talking to a friend of ours up in the Virginia area, Mike Warren, who played Scapeshift for years. And I got a little bit of assistance from him because, just like Alex said, he had the hours logged. He had all the resources. I showed him my 75. He said, okay, you should be good on these games. Watch out for these matchups. This is what I would do here and here. And it did. It helped me out a lot. It improved my play on Modo. And, I mean, I'm going to say greatly attributed to my win at the GPT.
What are your opinions on, Jerry?
Yeah, it, like you said, it helps out to have, like, if you're going to switch to a deck and you know someone who knows it, it helps out a ton when you need to be able to do that. And, you know, the modern format is rife with, you know, I can't play this deck because, you know, deck X is now super strong and I have no game against it. So, again, it's really good to have someone around who knows their game with a particular archetype.
Yeah, and kind of moving forward in this same kind of line of thought here. Shared sideboard guides, just in general. We've done this in the past where we have it on the drive. We have our deck list, our main deck. We have the 15 card sideboard, and we have a quick guide of this is how we sideboard. These matchups take, you know, this in, this out. Very simple, or maybe like a line of, you know, this is the reasoning why this comes out, or to say on the if they're running this card, because there are different flavors of decks in modern. You know, you can have two junk decks, you know, one of them doesn't run voice and one does, so when there's a voice involved, you need these certain cards and things like that. So I think shared sideboard guides are also very helpful, because not even just if somebody wants to pick up this deck and play it, they have a sideboard guide, but also just to see, oh, well, I'm playing against, you know, a deck that somebody in my playtest group plays, and they've talked to me, this is how they sideboard against me, so now you can kind of level and like, oh, I know they're bringing this card in, so I need to bring in this card, and that kind of thing.
Nope, absolutely true, and that was really good whenever we did have that on the drive, because, again, and it wasn't something that we really had a schedule, like, we all had to find the time to get together and meet up. No, it was just, we threw it up in our group chat. Hey, I've got this sideboard up on the drive of what I would bring in and what I would take out. When you guys get a chance, are you going to be able to, you know, take a look at it? In our own leisure throughout the week, we did that. We offered up our tips and advice, and it helped us out.
What do you think about shared sideboards, Jerry?
Shared sideboards, it's a unique beast because if I'm not familiar with something enough that requires me to play it out, and there aren't enough hours in the day, like you said, to be able to play, you know, other decks as well, to include to get to know your own craft. So it gets a little bit more difficult for me. But this is as far as myself goes personally. Other people can manage that much better than I can. But I can see where you're coming from with it. Put your sideboard out there, see what people say. Come across with, you know, as many answers as you can, come up with the best possible equation, you know, sort of like a good mix and match of, you know, different things coming around from different parts.
Yeah, I once again kind of stick with the sideboard train of thought here. What do you guys feel about playing sideboarded games versus, you know, game one, just the 60 versus 60 main deck games when you're playtesting?
Okay, so when I play test, I'm very methodical about it. I like to play 10 games to start, 10 total games, 4 of which are pre-sideboard, 6 of which are post-sideboard. Within those 6 that are post-sideboard, the first 4 are going to be my go-to sideboard, and the last 2 are going to be, you know, the final touches on what should have been sided in. You know, that's how I like to do it. It's not really a hindrance. I'm trying to think of the words to say it here, what I'm trying to say.
English, do you speak it?
Yeah, I don't speak much English these days.
Fair enough.
You know, I just like the 10 games. 10 games solid, 4 games pre, 4 games post-sideboard, and then the last 2 games, you know, the fixed version of what my sideboard should be.
That makes sense. How do you feel?
No, you definitely need to play more than just for game one, because you need to, it's nice to 2-0 a match, but you need to think you're going to be playing 2 games sideboard. So you need to make sure that what you believe is going to do well against a certain deck actually does. So yes, play your game once, see how the deck is just out the bat on its own. And then, you know, go into your sideboard games. Do exactly what you think you would do. And if you're doing the proxy ones, that's going to be a little bit more difficult because now you have to think along that player's lines. But it's also beneficial because now you have an idea of what they might bring in. But sideboard games are, I would say, a must in playtesting. You can't just focus on the raw 60. You need to look into the side and see if what your game plan is actually going to be beneficial or just a waste of time.
Yeah, no, I think it's something that a lot of, you know, newer players and stuff miss. They just want to, hey, man, want to play some games? Sure. And you play, you know, two main deck games. You're like, oh, you want a sideboard? And they're like, no, I don't want to. I just want to keep playing. I'm like, no, you got to, like, you have to learn how to sideboard with your deck. And then also, like, a matchup that you might think is fine. Like, oh, I just win every game one. But then they have, like, a Hosier card in the sideboard. Like, yep. Stony Silence, Rest in Peace. You know, whatever. Maybe they may have this in the sideboard to where the sideboard games are not in your favor. And you have to, like, play these games not in your favor to figure out how you can swing them back. You know, what do I need to do to try to make this a reasonable matchup? And also with that, you have to imagine, too, like, if you do play three games every round, which is likely, that you're going to play two sideboard games in one main. Like, yeah, the one main deck may be the most important because of time is a factor. You might not get to game three. But theoretically, you're playing more sideboard games than main deck.
Absolutely. And that's one thing that should not be lost at all throughout your time playing and things like that. It's not bad to go to three games either. Don't get discouraged.
Right.
No, I'm all about the, you know, you need to learn how to do sideboard games. A lot of new players, like you said, they do miss it. And when you're missing your sideboard games, effectively you're missing 66% of what you need to be learning. If you're only 33% effective because of what you have learned, that means you're going to go and win 33% of your matches. So that's, you're going to be outed in an open by round six. Doesn't sound like a good investment to me.
Right. And also with that, there are certain sideboard cards that are just not good on the player, the draw, depending. You know, then maybe they're too slow on the draw, or you want your deck to be faster on the play, so you bring something in when you're on the play to speed your deck up even more than vice when you're on the draw and stuff like that. And that's another thing a lot of people have a hard time with, too, is going back to the sideboard in between games.
Man, you mentioned that, you know, cards being better versus being on the play or the draw of the sideboard. Perfect example of this is one of my favorite counter spells ever printed in Spell Snare. For one mana, counter target spell with converted mana cost 2. So on the play, it's still fine. It's still fine, but you're not going to get the value you get out of Spell Snare is having it in your hand when you're on the draw, because you're going, you go your turn, you play your turn 1 island, and they're going to try and play their turn 2 Tarmogoyf or their turn 2 Voice of Resurgence or whatever 2 mana spell have you. You got your value out of it because, you know, since you won game 1, you want Spell Snare in your hand immediately, so you'll have 3 or 4 of them in your hand for game 2 when you're on the draw.
Yeah, that's one for sure. Like playing Blue Moon, I run 2 Spell Snares in the main, and I there are definitely matchups where I cut it, or, you know, a different sideboard game where I cut it. I am going to play a little bit of Devil's Advocate again because I do play. I think it's still fine on the play in certain matchups because I want to Serum Visions or Suspend an Ancestral on turn 1 and then have it up on turn 2 to use my mana more efficiently than my opponent.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying it's bad by no stretch. It's just it's much, much better when it was already good while you were on the play. Now it's even better on the draw.
Yeah, no, I can see that for sure.
And I think that's one of the more difficult things that is to learn, and is also one of the things that will help you step your game up even more, is knowing the good sideboard cards, whether you're on the play or on the draw, because, like we've been discussing, it can make the difference. And if you're able to learn that and then go back to the side, make those changes as it changes up between game 2 and game 3, if it does, it's going to help you out in the long run.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, I'm not trying to, you know, don't get you know, confused newer guys out there listening and stuff, like, sometimes it doesn't matter. Like, your sideboard is your sideboard. Like, cards are good always, and you're not going to go back to, you know, play draw. Like, actually, the player to draw sideboard cards are very rare. It's more uncommon, but it's something you need to learn.
Yep.
So that's pretty much, you know, bring us in here for playtest group. We got a little bit of time. You guys want to just... What, you got anything to talk about?
Actually, yeah.
Jerry, I know you like to talk. Yeah.
I got something. All right. So, have you guys seen Enter the Battlefield?
Yes, I did watch it.
All right. What were your opinions on it?
I thought it was well done. I liked how we followed, you know, the group of pros that they chose. I feel like they could have done more, but for an introductory Magic documentary, I think it's great. Someone who has never played the game, it's going to be great for them to watch, I think. But for us who know the scene, who know the not really the lives, but know the guys and kind of what they go through, it's all right.
All right. So.
Yeah, I think it kind of, it fell in this thing where I understand they wanted to talk about multiple different people to try to catch a wider audience. But I think they definitely would have benefited from a more focused story on less people.
Yep.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from on that. But, you know, I liked how they, you know, they hit on Melissa DeTora's deal where, you know, she's now working for Wizards. You know, they hit on Owen Turtenwald where his family has sacrificed so much for him, that type of thing. But then, here's the downside, and here's where I didn't like it. As much as I like all these players, I like watching them play this, that, it felt like there was a painted light to where, like, Owen Turtenwald and Reed Duke just came across as losers. Like, I got no other way to put it. You know, this guy lives with his mom, he's in his mid-20s, and he plays a card game still. You know, it kind of got painted across as that, and I didn't really like that. You know, most of us actually have, you know, real jobs on the other side while we enjoy this great hobby we have. And do you see where I'm coming from with this?
I see where you're coming from, but I think that was a point they're trying to make, though, is because it's life on the Pro Tour is, you know, the little subtitle. It's not about a hobby. It's not Magic as a hobby. It's this is what these people do to have to be successful at this game. A little bit was part of it.
Okay, yeah. Okay. But it just, you know, the whole... Did you have to point out that the guy, you know, lives with his mom every single day? You know, something like that? Like, it comes across as such a negative connotation because gamers are already, you know, put into a light of we all live in our parents' basements, you know, living off of their food and water, and we never come out only when something's going on the outside.
No, I get where you're coming from, and they definitely could have done a better job about that. I agree. But once again, as the point I made, it's about life on the Pro Tour, and this is what the people on the Pro Tour, that's how they live, and that's how they make a living.
Yep.
So they have to address that.
I don't think that the audience, though, that they're trying to capture for this, yes, they're trying to get new people into it, so there might be a couple that's like, oh, right, this guy's a pro, but he lives at home with his mom. I don't think they're really going to focus too much on that. I think it's going to be drawn more to the whole... holy crap, he's playing a card game and doing what? Or, you know, it could spark that interest in the people of, you know, I've seen it before, it looked kind of cool, I didn't realize there was this vast world of it.
Yeah. I understand where Jerry's coming from. They could have glamorized a little more. They could have, I think, a better way to have done that would have been to highlight where the Pro Tours were. Because, like, this was, you know... I think I can't remember where they all were, but I think one was like Barcelona or something. Like they're in Spain, a beautiful country. They could have shot more kind of scenery, like shown guys like walking up to the convention center and stuff, and shown that it's a beautiful place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they could have talked about how, you know, if you do well enough at a GP, you get free plane tickets to go there.
Or right, if you're, exactly.
You know, that definitely could have been highlighted because it would have glamorized it more. Than just the whole, well, maybe he's just spending all of his money on trying to go to these different places, trying to win, and he doesn't.
Right. Yes, yeah, so I definitely think there was things they omitted that they could have shown. I think, once again, I think that comes down to they just try to jam too many people in there. Like, if they just would have focused on, you know, I mean, Owen Reed and Patrick are fine to focus on, and Shahar Shinar is a good story too. Like, I think if you would have narrowed it, cut the field of people in the movie in half, I think you would have benefited from it as a whole.
Yeah.
So that was Jerry's thing. What do you got, Rob? You got anything you want to talk about?
Oh man, no, I've just been so deadlocked on getting ready for the GP and work, and like it's been my brain's just been all one line. I know you've been the same, getting ready. You're doing an impromptu.
Like, it was just going to be like a Grand Prix, so I was like, oh, I just have to do standard this month. That's fine. And then like I forgot there was an open in between there, like really close. So now then I had to cram modern this week, and it's been crazy.
Oh man, I would have lost my mind. I would be like, no, I don't have enough time to get ready for this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still excited though. I mean, once again, modern, we talked about it. It's a format where knowing your deck helps, and I know my deck pretty well, so I feel pretty good about that. But there's new things changing in modern. Eldrazi's not there anymore. There's a dredge deck again, apparently. So like there was new things I had to adjust to real quick.
Oh man. So screw it. Side note. I'm over here messing with my keyboard. I've had this hum in my ear the entire cast. I turned the lights off on my keyboard and it went away.
Okay, is your headphone cord laying over your keyboard?
No. Keyboard cord goes in the back, the headphones go in the front, and yeah, no lights, and it's perfectly fine. Weird. Right?
Good talk, Rob. Good talk.
Yeah, that's what I do.
All right, with that captivating story, that's going to do it for us this week. You guys got anything to throw out here at the end? Any plugs?
Turn off your keyboard lights.
That's just sound advice, Jerry. Everybody does that.
I'll go ahead. I'll plug everything. Please check out our website, www.thesnapcast.com. We've put up a couple more videos of the Snapcast plays. We're going to get videos of Jerry playing. We tried one. The audio failed on us. But we will.
I mean, it's mostly you, Rob. But
I know. And it wasn't the hum. It was something different. Check out our Facebook, facebook.com/thesnapcast. Our YouTube channel, we're putting all of our videos up there. Like, subscribe. Once we hit 100 subscribers, our actual YouTube channel name will be youtube.com/thesnapcastmtg. Right now, it's youtube.com/randomletters. So I apologize for lying to you people about that. So definitely stay tuned for all of that. Things are slowing down with my school, so I should be able to get a Twitch stream schedule up for myself. We'll talk to everybody else, see what we can do to get you the content you guys want. But we need to know what you want. Leave your feedback, comments, anything, segment you want to hear, something you want to see, let us know. Jerry talked me into buying Dragonstorm. I did.
That was a mistake.
It was terrible, but you give me the advice. If it looks good, I might do it. Or if you can talk me into it, I'll do it.
What can I say?
And that's all I have.
What can I say? I'm a chatty man, if you catch my drift.
No, you're not.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. That's going to do it for us. Later.
Oh, snap.